Welcome to the Talk Theater in Chicago podcast, your audio source for what's going on in the Chicago theater scene. Coming up on today's podcast, we have an interview with Gabe Green and Richard Pettengill. They will be talking to Ann Nicholson Weber about the theater-goer experience. And if you're a theater-goer, then you're definitely going to enjoy this interview. Also, we have an audio review, and of course, Chicago's theater news. So sit back and relax, and get ready to talk theater.
You're listening to Talk Theater in Chicago's interview podcast. I'm Ann Nicholson Weber, your host this week, and I'm here today with a show that's a little different. We're not going to talk about artists or particular shows. We're going to talk about being an audience member. And to join me in that conversation, I have Gabe Green, who is a literary manager at Steppenwolf Theater, and who also has worked as a freelance dramaturg for a number of companies around town, including Timeline Theater, Shattered Globe, and Noble Fool. And also with us today is Richard Pettengill, who is an assistant professor of theater and English at Lake Forest College. And he, too, has worked as a dramaturg, particularly at length with Court and Goodman Theaters. So welcome, Richard and Gabe.
Thank you, Anne.
I want to begin today with a quick quote from an interview I did with the great English actor, Simon Callow. And you have to imagine this in his plummy voice and his wonderful English accent. I'll do my best. He said, "In the theater, the audience is 50% of the experience. The theater is the ultimate original interactive experience. If people realize that, they might be rather more excited about it when they go to the cinema, where they are absolutely passive and have no influence on the event whatever. The all-important element of the theater is this living interchange. As the great music hall comedian Max Wall used to say at the end of every performance, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much. You have been half." So what I want to talk today about is being that half of the experience. I thought we could start by talking about the beginning of creating an experience as an audience member, which is choosing to go to a play. And first of all, how does one do that, and what information is available to help you do that, and what kinds of attitudes can help create a really great experience? Maybe Richard, you're nodding.
Sure. I think it's a very good question, because how does an audience member decide how to go see a certain play? I mean, there are certain resources out there. You look through the Reader or Chicago Magazine or the New York Times or whatever it is.
Or theaterinchicago.com.
Or theaterinchicago.com, yes, preferably. And you'll find various kinds of information, but how does one know that one wants to see this play? How does one trust the source, especially if that source is providing some kind of value judgment on the material at hand? Certainly, reviews, want to provide that as a service to consumers. You should see this show or you should not. Those of us in the theater really are not happy about that function of the reviewer as a consumer guide. So I think, those of us in the theater want to create a relationship with audience members that will result in them wanting to see our shows because of what we put forth about the shows. And there are a number of ways in which theaters now do that, all kinds of various media and communication channels that allow our audiences to know something about the shows so that they will want to come see them. And make their own judgment about what they see.
Mm-hmm. Gabe, maybe you could talk about some of the things that Steppenwolf in particular, or Timeline, another theater you've worked with a lot, the kinds of ways that theaters do that.
Sure, absolutely. Well, Steppenwolf has started putting up audio slideshows and blog postings. Our blog has been going on for about a year and a half now, and it's a way for people who are part of our family, and we encourage ownership, getting them informed a little bit about what the show's about. Of course, we're an ensemble-based theater, and when I'm going to a show as a civilian, it has a lot to do with that. I'm looking at theater companies that I know and whose work I respect. So if I don't necessarily know the writer or the play or the actors, I have a pretty good feeling about the theater company. And similarly, if it's a writer that I know and yet I'm less familiar with the theater company, it's a way of playing a kind of 6 degrees of whomever game to find shows and experiences that are likely to be beneficial to me.
Are there any disadvantages to going to a play with expectations like that? You feel like you know what this company does, or you know what, you know, these actors are about?
Well, it's possible that, yes, one of the things you like to do as an audience member, hopefully, is go in with an open mind and be ready to have expectations challenged, which I think is a large and important part of going to theater. So, yes, an open mind is certainly necessary, and there is a wealth of information out there. Of course, theaterinchicago.com, other periodicals that write previews of plays. And I actually quite like reading previews as opposed to reviews, because they do give a little bit of context and background about the writer or the performance or the historical event that inspired it, things mm-hmm. like that, that get you into the world of the play without necessarily revealing too much about it.
Well, that brings up an interesting issue, which we talked about very quickly before we started recording, which is the question of whether it's good or not to have read the play before you go. Obviously, there are classical plays that many theater goers will already know, and you're gonna know how it's gonna come out if you go to Hamlet, for instance. But particularly with new work, I guess there might be two opinions about that. And Richard, you had something to say about that.
Well, you know, now that I teach theater full time at a college, I pretty routinely have my students read plays before we go to see them. And certainly when we go to Chicago Shakespeare Theater or something like that, I think there's absolute benefit to reading Troilus and Cressida before you try to really absorb that text as it's delivered on stage. You get a whole lot more out of it if you've worked it through in advance. However, I think there are some plays that really do not need to be read in advance, and in fact should not be. I mean, and in fact, I recently took my students to see a production that Gabe worked on as a dramaturg, a production of Brett Nevue's Harmless at the Timeline Theater, and I did get a copy of the script in advance and shared it with my students, but they all said afterwards, you know, we really probably shouldn't have read that play before we saw it, because, you know, there was really no need to. We certainly could fully understand the play entirely in performance, and we would rather have not known how it evolved, and it really was better to experience it as performance. So that, you know, that was a good point, because I think for me it's sort of a knee-jerk thing to give them the script, and I assume that's a good thing. But it reminded me that there are times when really just going in almost cold can be a good thing. Now, having said that, there are other kinds of things that I had them look at, which were Gabe's lobby panels, where he provided all kinds of information about issues that are raised by the play. And those the students thought were very, very useful to have read in advance in terms of understanding and having a deeper understanding of some of the issues raised by that play.
Well, that's kind of you to say.
Let me backtrack one step, which is to say Gabe on that show was working in the capacity of a dramaturg, which is something that I think not everybody knows what that is. Kind of like when
including
the credits,
a lot of dramaturgs.
Yeah, right. The credits go by in the movie and you see Best Boy and you say, you know, who is the Best Boy? So who is the dramaturg? And Richard, I know you actually teach that, so maybe you could quickly answer that, and then we'll go to Gabe talking about
it. Well, a dramaturg is a person in the theater that's been around in America for the last 25 or 30 years, but it's an old tradition in Germany since the late 18th century. It's a person in the theater who tends to have their focus on the text of the play in terms of if it's a script that needs explanation or illumination in terms of obscure references or difficult phrases or anything like that. Usually or often the dramaturg will do various kinds of research to illuminate the play for the artists involved with the production, the director, the actors, the designers. They might do contextual research into, say, the times in which the play was written, the life of the playwright, critical essays on the play, if there are any, past productions, if it's an older play. I have my students do image collage kinds of research to stimulate the imaginations of artists, and also sometimes to create educational materials to enhance the appreciation of the play for audience members, whether they're adult audience members or school you know, students coming from schools. So the lobby panels that I referred to that Gabe had done for Harmless by Brett Nevue were a good example of dramaturgical materials being provided to the audience for their, you know, to enhance their understanding of the piece.
Well, and Gabe, maybe you could talk about what the issues in the play were that you focused on in creating those materials and what that process was like.
Sure. This play, Harmless, which is now closed, is about a meeting that takes place on a small liberal arts college between the president of the university, a creative writing professor, and a army psychologist who is flown in because of the short story that one of the creative writing professor's students has written. The student is, who never appears on stage, is a Iraq War vet, and in his creative writing class has written a very graphic, violent story about, we never exactly find out what about, but it sounds vaguely Abu Ghraib-ish. So in doing research for this play, we try to suss out the major themes of the play, which is how have soldiers been treated historically when they return with post-traumatic stress disorder? What has been the history of soldiers who have returned from war and written about their experiences? What, you know, Joseph Heller, Kurt Vonnegut. The day we went into rehearsal on this, there was an NPR story about soldiers who had returned home from Iraq and not only not finding the treatment they needed, but also reports of other soldiers being sent back, having been diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder, mm-hmm. being sent back to the front lines.
Well, was the research that you did to create the lobby panels, which included, you said, things like the history of how cultures have dealt with post-traumatic stress disorder, was that the same research you did for the artists' work? Was that stuff that you would have given the actors, for instance, or...
Well, actually, post-traumatic stress disorder, yes. I actually spent more time breaking down elements of the story. For example, for the creative writing professor, I gave him syllabi of creative writing classes, articles about what life as an adjunct professor was like, the tenuous nature of such a position.
So some of it's the same and some of it's different, you're saying.
Exactly. I think more for the character, for the actors trying to situate their character in a world, mm-hmm. and for taking a wider scope with the audience, which is just a wider look at this world.
Right. They're not looking at it through the eyes of one particular character.
Exactly.
Particularly. Well, so that's an example of the kind of enrichment materials you might give an audience with a contemporary play, with a new play. Is it different when you dramaturg a classical play, for instance?
Absolutely. And the very next show at Timeline, which just opened, Widower's Houses, is the first play of George Bernard Shaw's. And notable because it's his first play. It's seldom produced. And so you have a writer that everybody is familiar with, whose works a lot of people are familiar with a play that absolutely no one is familiar with.
Uh-huh.
So it's... It's a terrific production, by the way. I need to pimp the production. I told Nick Bowling I would. But, it's a totally different world. Instead of 2004 USA of Harmless, we're in 1892 Victorian London, where currency is foreign, the situations are foreign. Of course, the themes of the play are as timely as ever, which is, of course, why Timeline chose to do it. But the lobby displays focus on this kind of unknown chapter of Shaw's life. You know, why did he write this play? What were the origins? What turned him to playwriting at age 41? And what are the background? What are the slums of London that this play discusses? What were they really like?
So just factual things that an audience member might be confused by or references.
Absolutely.
Can be explained.
Just
by that
putting
kind
them
of material.
In the world.
Yeah.
But that's an interesting question, though, about whether you give the artists during the production process and the audience similar materials. Certainly, I, as a dramaturg, often will give the audience primary materials that I've given the artists that seem to me to have a particular impact on them, on their perspective, and on thus on the production itself.
You mean after you've seen the performance evolve, you see that seems to have really
that
had an
seems
influence.
To have landed. And
yes,
so
yes.
Instead of telling the audience anything like, "What is this play about?" give them some of the you know, the primary sources, like, say, a passage from an essay, a bit of information about the author, something that doesn't sort of say, here's what this show is about, and certainly doesn't say, here's what this director is wanting to do with this production, but rather gives them some of the same information that illuminated the play for the artists in the hope that it will illuminate the production for them in a similar way.
Well, that brings us, I think, to the process of sitting down in a seat in a theater and watching the lights go down and beginning to participate in the play with whatever you've brought into the theater. And what are the ways, and Richard, you said you had things to say on this topic, what are the ways that an audience member can be participating more actively, can be more the half that Max Wahl talks about?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's important for audience members to realize, and I think everyone kind of knows this on some level, but if you think in terms of the play or the stage itself as a clean slate, as a tabula rasa, and that everything you see on that stage is the result of an artistic choice, that if you think in those terms, then you realize that everything you see, there is nothing that is random. Everything has an intention. Now, as to what that is, I think what's wonderful about this is that audiences can make that up for themselves. Mm. And I always try to resist answering directly questions from audience members when they say, so what did the director have in mind with that? Or I'm like, well, what did you think? You
know?
So if I get four or five of them to say what they thought, and they generally tend to be different things, then I'll say, great, and that's interesting because what the director said was that.
Uh-huh.
And so we can then share all these various ideas about it. But, you know, I think audiences should realize that there are a number of artists involved in what they're seeing. There's the director who's, of course, the overarching, you know, visionary of the whole thing, or should be. There are the designers. Every piece of clothing you see is the result of a choice. Generally, those choices are very, very carefully discussed and considered. Color choice, choice of fabric, the cut of the clothing, everything is very, very carefully done. The furniture, all of this, it's all done very intentionally to put across something to an audience that reflects an artistic point of view on the part of the designers and the director. So I think if audiences think creatively in those terms, they will get a lot more out of what they're seeing. That's one reason that I often encourage people to read the script, because when you read the script, you become your own director and designer. You visualize everything you're seeing on the page. You're envisioning the world in which the play is happening, the clothes that are being worn, the actors who are doing the parts, the set itself, and so on. So that when then you go and you encounter the work of another set of artists who have brought their own vision to the piece, you're in a position to actually contrast your own initial view of the script, your own vision, with the vision that you encounter. And I think it gives you a much stronger footing to evaluate and discuss the nature of that artistic achievement.
Sure, it forces you to look at your own choices and examine why, and
precisely.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Although I could imagine, it's interesting, this is reminding me of I'm trying to remember what the context was, but it was a director talking about having given the script of a new play to, I believe, a reviewer. I can't quite imagine under what condition that would have happened. But anyway, which meant that the reviewer cast the show in his mind, designed the show, and came and said, well, this isn't what I like. This isn't what I would have done. I mean, I could imagine that there's a way in which if you come as an audience member, as a tabula rasa, not having created your own production in your head, maybe you're more open to other decisions. What do you think about that?
I think that's a good point. And when I encounter that tendency with students to say, well, it wasn't the way I envisioned it, what I just try to encourage them to say, look, what we're here to analyze and discuss rather than to judge. You know, leave the judging to the critics. I want you, though, to put yourself into the shoes of those artists and say, oh, okay, I see why they made that choice. Here's what I think they probably had in mind. Even though it's different from my vision, here's what I think they were up to in making that shirt red and in that couch green.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, a lot of people listening to this aren't, you know, don't have the opportunity to read these new plays
right
beforehand. I mean, students are a special case. And with new plays, a lot of times they're not published. And so you're, as an audience member, you go in and you're, you know, I think that you're wanting to be open-minded and willing to engage with this play on the ideas that it's putting forth and the questions that it's asking.
Yeah, I think there is something very exciting about going to a new play because you do go without expectations. And in some way, being a naive consumer in that way, you may have a more honest response. There can be that effect that you go to a play that's been a huge hit and everybody's talking about buzz, 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 and you go in and you almost can't have your own response to it because you're programmed to think something. Or what often happens to me, the opposite, that there's been this huge buzz, it's going to be so great, and then it falls short, and I'm much more mad about it than I would have been if I had gone in expectation free.
Yeah, I'm much happier when I go to a show expecting not to like it and then I'm pleasantly surprised.
Right. Well, and is there, I mean, I wonder if there's any conflict between the kind of intellectual processing that you're talking about, Richard, where you're really thinking, well, that could have been green, but it's red. Why is it red? What does that mean? And a more emotional, just letting it hit you kind of response. Do you think there's a conflict there?
Well, I think, you know, every now and then my students, you know, say, can't we just go see it?
Right.
Why do you make us, you know? It's like,
right.
Okay, you know, and certainly, as Gabe said, on a practical level, most audience members are not going to do this anyway.
Right.
So this is just, I just think this is an opportunity for students to experience theater in this way. I'm not suggesting that they even have to go through their lives and read the text in advance, you know, but it just does give them that experience. And I think there can be a tendency to, when you see something out of the blue, you've never seen it before, to assume that that's the way it must be. I'm just trying to promote the notion of multiplicity, of multivalent approaches, that the text isn't just an unbelievably rich, has unbelievably rich potential for multiple mm-hmm. points of view. I mean, I think one of the rewards of having a lifelong obsession with going to the theater is that inevitably you see multiple productions of the same play. And this does it really beautifully. And then you see this production of Lear and
right.
that production of Lear,
right.
and you see that they were entirely different,
right.
and that makes the point perhaps better than any other.
Right. I had very early on in my theater-going career the experience of seeing a production at Stratford in Ontario of Hamlet, where the Hamlet was double cast, but only the Hamlet. It was Nick Pennell and Richard Bonnet. And the rest of the cast was the same, obviously the sets, the costume. So it was like a carefully controlled experiment in acting. And the two interpretations by those two actors were miles apart. And so it was the first time that I woke up to the fact that how much an actor does. The words were the same, but it was a different person in front
right.
of me. And it was very exciting for me, is that I was 14 or something.
I had a similar experience in high school when I read King Lear. This was 1970, oh my. And that was the year that Peter Brook's film of Lear came out, and my teacher took us to see that film, and I really was completely stunned by Brook's bleak, unrelentingly without hope vision of the play. He excised all the lines that could give any glimmer of possibility of happiness in this earth. It was all Beckettian, kind of really spare and difficult. But it was an uncompromising vision, and it hit me on the head. It felt, you know, like the top of my head had been taken off, just the way Emily Dickinson talks about poetry.
Okay,
it's
yeah.
like,
yeah.
top of my head was taken off by this vision, and that's when I realized I had just read the play, but there are any number of ways to see it. I couldn't begin to envision the play in the way he did.
Well, and then there's the wonderful experience of reading, particularly Shakespeare, which is not always so accessible to us as modern Americans because of the distance of the language and the culture. And particularly my experience is you read all those clown scenes and you say, this is funny. And then if you see it done really well, you realize, oh, yeah, this is funny, but it's not on the page. And that's, of course, what artists bring to it is the ability to see what the playwright knew about where that comedy could come from.
And the dramaturg elucidated.
Very important.
Right. All right, well, we've gotten our audience through a performance, and now they're leaving the theater. And I wonder if there are, again, resources or attitudes or approaches that can retroactively enrich the experience that you've just had.
We can get them to stay a little longer and talk with the actors at a post-show discussion.
Sure, if I can speak to for the home team for a second. Yeah, this is something that's become a major issue at Steppenwolf and certainly a timeline as well where I frequently collaborate. One of the things that we're developing now at Steppenwolf is this ongoing notion of the public square, both in a literal sense that the theater is where people gather, and in a more metaphorical level, which is to say, this is a place where ideas and conversations happen, and it's a two-way exchange rather than the traditional economic model of you pay X number of dollars and receive your entertainment. Instead, it's wanting to foster a conversation. And so, yeah, we Timeline does it. Steppenwolf offers post-show discussions after all 8 performances a week, led by a member of the admin staff, usually with actors there. And, yeah, this continuing the conversation through a blog, through the materials that both theaters provide as their program. Both theaters use as the shell of their program articles about the play, contextual stuff, things that may not directly address the play, but help frame it in a contextual sphere.
Well, and of course, that's a choice too. What you put in those pages is another artistic choice in a way that's going to be affecting the experience that the audience members
Absolutely.
Have, and I think can be very profoundly affecting what you see, what you notice, what leaps out at you.
Yeah.
Well, now I'm going to say something possibly provocative. I am not a big fan of post-show discussions in general. In general, my experience of them is that they're a couple of blowhards who get up and give 3-paragraph questions that are designed to say, I'm really smart. And then... and which the actors always very graciously try to turn into something. Yeah. And then the feeling I have often, and people had a reaction, but they can't quite articulate what it is that they want to get at. And I'm just interested to hear either of you respond to that.
Well, I think, in the best of circumstances, a post-show discussion can help somebody who actually is unable to sort of articulate what they feel or think about a show to actually process a bit, discuss a bit, ask some questions, hear some thoughts, and come to kind of more of a clear point of view about just what they did think about the show.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the whole thing of processing can be granted, sometimes you do get these long-winded types who go on and on, but in the best of situations, it's a chance for audiences to really ask questions, to find out. But I think most importantly, for the artists to elicit the responses mm-hmm. of the audience, to get them to talk, get them to come out with their responses, and to propagate the notion that whatever response they have is valid because it is their response to the work.
Mm-hmm.
Very often people are afraid to speak. They feel like, oh, whatever I have to say is not right because what is correct is what the director thought, when in fact that's not true.
Yeah.
Often what the director thinks about his or her production is not at all the way people respond to it, and therefore it's perfectly valid for that artist, but not for the receiver of the work. So it's important to give audiences, I think, that opportunity to come forth.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's, a really useful point, that the artists, I think, are very hungry for sincere responses, just to know, how did it really play? Because you put it out there, and you can tell when an audience is engaged, you can tell when it's succeeding. That, I think, is generally palpable. But exactly how it landed, what sense they made of it, I think is kind of a mystery, unless this sort of dialogue gets going. I don't know, Gabe, maybe you can speak to any examples of specific things that ever happened in those discussions that were valuable or rewarding for any of the artists?
Sure. Well, and a lot of it happens with new works as well. We've premiered a bunch of Bruce Norris's plays, which are kind of in your face, visceral stuff. And it's fun to talk with them afterwards because it's the audiences, because they, there's no time has elapsed.
Mm-hmm.
3 minutes maybe has elapsed, and they're still making sense of this, trying to unpack what they've just seen. And it's especially with that work, it affronts people, and the responses to that both tell you how this play is operating and how it's operating on audiences, and mm-hmm. in turn, you know, that tells the people involved in the play, the actors and director, what they're doing right or wrong, I think.
Uh-huh. So some real instant feedback on yeah. what you're doing. Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, sometimes post-show discussions can serve a function as part of the production process. For example, during preview performances, The feedback that we receive from audiences often is very much incorporated into the subsequent rehearsals as the show is refined toward the opening night. Mm-hmm. So that after opening, they become really conversations about the work, but prior to opening, they can have an impact on the development of the work itself.
Well, and I think, isn't it true that even over the course of a run, the play may shift? I mean, as the actors get deeper into it and maybe learn more. So it maybe isn't even a closed door after opening night.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think maybe we'll let the audience members go home and have their own conversations without any comment on that. But this has been really interesting for me. Gabe Green and Richard Pettengill, I want to thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for having us.
Hello, Chicago, and welcome to another endearing episode of the Talk Theater in Chicago News podcast. I'm your host, Dustin Mote, bringing you Chicago's theater news for the week of May 21st, 2007. The Neo-Futurists have announced the movies for the 6th annual It Came from the Neo-Futurarium. Just when you thought it was safe to go back into the theater, the Neo-Futurists are presenting their 6th annual staged readings of some of the most obscure, trashy, goofy, bizarre, cheesy, and all-around terrible film scripts of all time. This year's slate for It Came from the Neo-Futurarium is an exciting one. It starts off on June 21st. The movies for this year's productions will include Xanadu, Dream Quest, Mesa of the Lost Women, Madame X, After School Specialicious, and that's a triple feature, and The Ten Commandments. It Came from the Neo-Futurarium 6, The Curse of the Neo-Futurarium, will be running from June 21st to July 26th. Tickets are available. For more information, click on over to Talk Theater in Chicago's Theater News section. The Joseph Jefferson Awards Committee have announced the special 2007 Citation Awards to two theaters. Those theaters will be Stage Left and Lifeline Theaters. Wrigleyville's Stage Left and Rogers Park Lifeline Theater will be honored for their contributions to the Chicago theater scene over the past years. Both are considered mainstays of Chicago's non-union theater community, and the Jeff Committee will be honoring them for their dedication to presenting new material. The special awards will be presented at the Jeff Award Citation Ceremony that will be held on Monday, June 11th at the Park West in downtown Chicago. The doors open at 6 o'clock and tickets are $30 in advance. You may have seen some of the Jeff Award-nominated shows, or you may have seen a show at Stage Left or Lifeline, and maybe you want to honor them as well. For information on the Jeff Award Citation recipients, tune in to Talk Theater in Chicago's news podcast on June 18th, because just like you, we are eagerly awaiting as well. In the meantime, congratulations to Stage Left and Lifeline Theater. Infamous Commonwealth Theater Company will be holding their Infamous Idol contest at Hamburger Mary's on Tuesday, June 12th. This is a karaoke contest where you show up, sign up, and perform some of your best musical chops in front of Randy, Paula, and Simon. Don't worry, it's not the real Randy, Paula, and Simon, just actors made up to look like them. They will choose the top 5 finalists, and those 5 will get to perform a second song in order to win some valuable prizes. This is, of course, a fundraiser for Infamous Commonwealth Theater, which does some wonderful work here in town. All proceeds from the Infamous Idol fundraising benefit will support Infamous Commonwealth Theater's 2007-2008 season, which is dedicated to the topic of righteousness. For more information, stay tuned to Talk Theater in Chicago's Theater News Podcast. The Tribune Stage Ticker is reporting that Lou Diamond Phillips will be replacing Sir Michael York as King Arthur in the national tour of Camelot that will be once the show gets into Los Angeles this September. Now, many of you may remember seeing Sir Michael York when he starred as Arthur in Camelot here in Chicago, or perhaps you participated in the auction where you could receive a replica of his sword. He served the part excellently, and I'm sure film star Lou Diamond Phillips will as well. But just as a side note, I will always remember Sir Michael York in that role. Well, thank you for listening to this endearing episode of the Talk Theater in Chicago News Podcast. We have come to the end of the news, but before we let you go, it's time for your Shakespeare quote of the week. The following quote comes from Macbeth, Act 5, Scene 1. What's done cannot be undone. Well, thank you very much for listening to this podcast. Remember, we are here every Monday with a new episode ready to stick in your ears. So until next time, Chicago, I'm your host, Dustin Mote, reminding you that theater's happening. Don't miss it.
You're listening to the Talk Theater in Chicago Review Podcast, Arcadia by Tom Stoppard, directed by Charles Newell at Court Theater in Chicago, Illinois. Review by Tom Williams. Arcadia is Tom Stoppard's masterpiece, and it was a wonderful night at the theater. Director Charles Newell utilizes his three-quarter thrust stage effectively at Court Theater on Matthew York's drawing room set, complete with a large rectangular table and a tall bookcase. Newell's casting is superb, featuring a wonderful assortment of classical actors led by Mary Beth Fisher as Hannah and Kevin McKillop as Bernard Nightingale. Arcadia is a whimsical work. It's part comedy of manners, part scientific mystery, part romantic drama, and part historical discourse on mathematics, physics, romanticism, classicism, and human nature, all presented in a fast-paced, marvelously acted, beautifully written play. Arcadia is a time-traveling detective story that jumps from 1809 to 1889, as the same English country house is the scene of both the past and present events. And scholars from both eras struggle to solve the mysteries involving ideas including classic, gothic, and modern ideas and modes of scientific thinking. Arcadia is a most entertaining scholarly work, not an easy task. Stoppard is recognized as a masterful playwright, with hints of Bernard Shaw, Oscar Wilde, together with sprinkles of Arthur Miller, Clifford Odets, and Noel Coward. He is basically a teacher whose command of language makes subject matter such as mathematics, chaos theory, landscape architecture, Lord Byron, romanticism, and investigative historical scholarship not only interesting, but understandable. As a playwright, Stoppard's craftsmanship has him seamlessly weaving a romantic comedy within a mystery in two separate time periods, utilizing exquisite verbiage filled with sharp wordplay, double entendres in a poetically gorgeous dialogue that contains laughs, poignancy, and drama in a cleverly structured, coherent story. His characters are fully developed, memorable, and underscore their ideas with wily traits and quirks. Arcadia opens in an 1809 drawing room of Sidley Manor as Septimus, played by Grant Goodman, is tutoring 13-year-old Tomasima, played by Bethany Caputo, whose amazing insights into physics and mathematical theory astound Septimus. During the lesson, the girl wants him to explain what carnal embrace means. He mumbles some cute banter, but she insists he become more specific as she learns a life lesson. Her mother, Lady Croom, played by Kate Fry, is having an affair with the tutor and others, as she also has a new garden being designed to include a hermitage. References to the poet Ezra Chatter, played by Raymond Fox, whose wife the tutor had sex with, and a copy of his poetic works are clues to set up the mysteries of the past. Next, we flash forward to the present-day Sidley Manor, where methodical investigative writer Hannah Jarvis, played by the wonderful Mary Beth Fisher, is staying at Sidley to research the hermit for a book. Her friend-slash-fiancé and current master of the estate, Valentine Coverley, played by Eric Hellman, is a mathematics professor working on probability theories. When the passionate, eccentric, pure romantic, pompous academic Bernard Nightingale, played by Kevin MacKillop, arrives to research his theory that Lord Byron killed the obscure poet Ezra Charter in 1809 at Sidley Manor, he immediately enters into a love-hate joint venture research project with Hannah. Add the sensual Chloe, played by Cassandra Bissell, and the savant Gus, played by Gregory Anderson, who adores Hannah, and Stoppard has set up a modern intellectual romantic comedy. With excellent work from Grant Goodman as Septimus and the articulate Kate Fry as Lady Croom, the early 19th century manor is ripe with indiscreet sexual trysts as their actions lead the modern investigators astray. Director Newell effectively moves his cast back and forth in time to weave an easily understandable story. In the modern scenes, I liked the manic, passionate, yet funny work from Kevin MacKillop as the arrogant professor, Eric Hellman as the intense Valentine, and Mary Beth Fisher as the repressed and angry Hannah gave excellent performances. Stoppard's complex plot and multi-themed work is an exercise highlighting the dilemma in trying to understand the past and the problems science faces in its attempt to qualify all life's experiences. Sexual attraction is the variable that thwarts scientific formulas for human behavior. Stoppard, ever the teacher, cleverly gets us pondering ideas like the nature of truth as he entices us with the twin mysteries of who was the hermit in Sidley Manor, and did Lord Byron really kill the obscure poet in a duel? You'll have to get to the Court Theater to see for yourself. Once more, Court Theater proves why they are among the best theater companies in all of Chicago. I give this a highly recommended rating. Arcadia, by Tom Stoppard and directed by Charles Newell, at Court Theater, located at 5535 South Ellis Avenue in Chicago, Illinois. Running time is 3 hours with one intermission, now running through June the 10th. For tickets and more information, please call 773-753-4472.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Talk Theater in Chicago podcast. I would like to thank Gabe Green and Richard Pettingill for giving us the honor of interviewing them this week. I would also like to thank Ann Nicholson Weber and Mark Meyer. Without them, this podcast would not be possible. And also, I would like to thank you, our listening audience. Remember, we are here every Monday with a new episode, ready for your listening pleasure. So until next time, I'm your host, Dustin Moat, reminding you that theater's happening. Don't miss it.